From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A major leader of the anti-apartheid movement is dead. Walter Sisulu was 90 years old. He spent a quarter of a century imprisoned on Robben Island with Nelson Mandela. Today, we'll speak with the head of the South African National Assembly, Frenny Ginwala. The man who wrote the Book of Virtues, the former drug czar of the United States, Bill Bennett, has been exposed as a high-stakes gambler. He now says he'll do it no more. And we look at transcripts that have been released on the secret questioning by Senator Joseph McCarthy. Among those questioned, Aaron Copland and Langston Hughes. All that and more coming up. Okay. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. officials gave the first details yesterday of their plan to set up an interim Iraqi government. It will likely be headed by a council of as many as 9 leaders, the majority of whom would be drawn from U.S.-backed Iraqi exile groups that have yet to demonstrate popular support in Iraq. The head administrator of U.S.-occupied Iraq, Lieutenant General Jay Garner, said the nucleus of the interim Iraqi government would be emerging by the end of the month. Garner named 5 figures who've already begun meeting. All were Kurdish or exile leaders who have long been backed and financed by the United States. They are Ahmed Chalabi of the Iraqi National Congress, Masoud Barzani of the Kurdistan Democratic Party, Jalal Talabani of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, Abdulaziz Hakim of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and Ayad Alawi of the Iraqi National Accord. The Washington Post reports Garner visited Basra for the first time. After Garner met with hospital officials, an Iraqi man trailed him, carrying a small boy of about 5 years old, with both legs in casts. Blood seeped from the foot of one cast as the man tried to attract Garner's attention. Garner, who was surrounded by bodyguards and aides, shook hands with the hospital director and, without appearing to notice, the man left to visit an oil refinery. The UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency, the IAEA, is urging Washington to allow it to investigate nuclear sites in Iraq that have reportedly been looted, but Washington has ignored the requests. The agency is concerned that radioactive material known to be stored at several Iraqi sites could pose health and environmental risks. There are also fears the waste could be used to create a so-called dirty bomb. Over the weekend, The Washington Post and New York Times ran articles indicating the U.S. had taken few measures to secure former nuclear sites. The Post reported at the Baghdad Nuclear Research Facility, Iraqis had been, quote, coming in by the score for the past 2 weeks. Radioactive material is scattered around the site. The U.S. is saying that it has captured Dr. Huda Salimadi Amash, one of Saddam Hussein's most senior biological weapons scientists. She is number 53 on the U.S. list of 55 most wanted Iraqi leaders. She was one of the few women in Saddam Hussein's inner circle. This news from Gaza. The parents of a British peace activist who was shot in the head by Israeli troops came under fire themselves as they traveled to the spot where their son was critically injured. The London Independent reports Anthony and Jocelyn Herndl were in a British diplomatic convoy entering the town of Rafah in the Gaza Strip when Israeli soldiers at a checkpoint fired a shot, which passed narrowly over the top of their vehicles. The Herndl's eldest son, Tom, is in a coma in an Israeli hospital after he was shot 3 weeks ago while trying to reach 2 Palestinian children. The U.S. military is preparing to release about 15 prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. This includes as many as 3 boys, aged between 13 and 16 years old, who were captured in Afghanistan more than a year ago. they'd been held at Guantanamo for this time. The Washington Post reports the Pentagon plans to expedite decisions about whether to prosecute, continue interrogating, or release the more than 660 prisoners held at the detention facility. This comes after criticism from Secretary of State General Colin Powell. A mission by three Southern African leaders aimed at resolving the political crisis in Zimbabwe of President Robert Mugabe ended in dismal failure yesterday. This according to a report in the London Independent. South Africa's President Thabo Mbeki, the Nigerian leader President Obasanjo, and the Malawian President Bakili Muluzi jetted into Harare yesterday for meetings with President Mugabe in the hope this would lead to a deal for the 79-year-old Mugabe's retirement and the installation of a new president from Mugabe's ZANU-PF party. The talks also included a representative from an opposition party that is challenging Zimbabwe's last election. Mugabe rejected any talks of stepping down until the opposition drops its lawsuits and recognizes him as Zimbabwe's official leader. The University of California, Berkeley, will turn away new students from China, Taiwan, Singapore, and Hong Kong this summer in what is believed to be the first such move by a major university to prevent the spread of SARS. Meanwhile, in China, 10,000 people have been quarantined in the eastern city of Nanjing. In China, SARS has claimed 214 lives and infected more than 4,400 people. Newly released transcripts indicate Senator Joseph McCarthy used closed-door secret sessions to winnow out witnesses who might have challenged him in the sensational anti-communism trials of the 1950s. Of the 500 witnesses who testified in private, one-third were never called back to testify in public. Among those who testified in private were the composer Aaron Copland, poet Langston Hughes, mystery writer Dashiell Hammett. Copland fiercely defended himself, saying, "I have not been a communist in the past, and I am not now a communist." Hughes protested that he had not read much about Marxism, quote, beyond the introduction of the Communist Manifesto. Hammett invoked the Fifth Amendment. McCarthy was a Wisconsin Republican. He led the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations in 1953 and 1954 at the height of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. His investigation into communists and the U.S. government was widely seen as a witch hunt and spawned the term McCarthyism to describe smear attacks. We'll have more on that story later in the program. Congress may soon pass a controversial new law that would shield gun manufacturers and dealers from lawsuits filed by victims of gun crimes. The bill has been the focus of a major lobbying push by the NRA and a lesser-known organization called the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which has raised $100 million over the past 5 years from gun makers to fight lawsuits and fund its national political campaign. A recent article in the Washington Post quotes a top aide to Senate Democrat, to a Senate Democrat who calls the bill the, quote, "things you've got to do to get reelected" act. A Colombian provincial governor, a former defense minister, and eight military personnel were killed in a failed rescue attempt near the northern Colombian town of Urao on Monday. They were among the 80 hostages the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, have been holding to negotiate the release of political prisoners. The Colombian government immediately blamed the rebels for the murders, which were described as execution-style killings. But a FARC spokesperson read a communique on local radio blaming the deaths on a botched rescue attempt by government forces. In the Philippines, the government has called off talks with the main Muslim separatist group, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. This comes 2 days after about 30 people died in an attack by the group. And finally, a veteran of South Africa's anti-apartheid movement died last night. Walter Sisulu was 90 years old. He spent a quarter of a century in jail alongside his close friend, Nelson Mandela. They were both sentenced to life in 1964 for plotting sabotage and revolution and detained on Robben Island until the apartheid regime finally relented and released him in 1989. We'll have more on that story in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. One of the leaders of the movement against apartheid in South Africa has died. Walter Sisulu passed away last night. He died 2 weeks before his 91st birthday. He spent a quarter of a century in prison for his organizing against the apartheid regime. Walter Maxwell Yate Sisulu was born in the Eastern Cape. His mother, Alice Sisulu, was a black domestic worker. His father, Victor Dickinson, was a white assistant magistrate. The first time Walter Sisulu ever saw a train was when he rode one that took rural recruits to work at the Rose Deep Mine. Sisulu also worked as a domestic worker, paint mixer, advertising agent, and newspaper columnist. His family was forcibly removed from their home in Doornfontein to the New Orlando Township in 1934. Hundreds of thousands of black South Africans were forcibly removed from their homes and forced into teeming townships during the apartheid era. In 1944, Sisulu, Nelson Mandela, and Oliver Tambo founded the African National Congress Youth League. The Youth League revolutionized the ANC, transforming it from a minor political party into a mass-based liberation movement. Sisulu was the organizing genius behind the ANC's major political protests in the 1950s. He eventually entered the armed wing of the ANC, Umkhonto weSizwe, or Spear of the Nation. He was arrested six times in 1962, and after going underground a year later, was arrested in July of 1963. The white apartheid regime sentenced Sisulu to life in prison for plotting sabotage and revolution. He was imprisoned on Robben Island with his close friend Nelson Mandela for a quarter of a century. Walter Sisulu was released in 1989 at the age of 77 as the mass popular movement forced the apartheid regime to begin negotiating a transfer of power. He immediately resumed his organizing. He was elected deputy president of the African National Congress in 1991 and was part of the ANC team that negotiated with the ruling National Party. South Africa's first democratic election was held in April 1994. We turn now to Dr. Frenny Ginwala. She is Speaker of the South African National Assembly. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's very good to have you with us. Can you start off by reflecting on the life of Walter Sisulu?
Yes. Well, he was so much a part of the ANC and of struggle in South Africa. It's very difficult to imagine things going on without him. And yet he bequeathed us with a kind of spirit and a kind of tradition that meant people will continue. He epitomized in his life his commitment, his determination, his courage, as well as his kindness and, of course, his sense of humor, that he epitomized everything we aspired to as a society and as a people. Hello.
Frenny Ginwala, can you talk about your own personal experience with Walter Sisulu. Can you talk about the phone call you received in 1960? This was long ago, long before the quarter of a century that he spent in prison.
That's right. Well, he changed my life. I had known him as a student activist, and he taught me a lot about the nature of the ANC. But out of the blue, I didn't know him very well. I mean, he was one of our great leaders, and I was just a student. When he asked me to arrange for Oliver Tambo, the then deputy president, to leave the country. And of course, I suppose it's the ignorance of youth. I blithely agreed, not knowing what I was letting myself in for, and left the country to make the arrangements. Then Sharpeville happened, and Oliver Tambo did come out. We got him out of the country. And 31 years later, when I met Walter Sisulu, I asked him, I said, why me? Why did you ask me to do this? And he just looked at me and he said, well, I thought you could do it. And I think that was typical of him. He was surprised that I should even ask, because I think his attitude was, all of us did, and he did what we were asked. We were part of the struggle. And you therefore continued in that way. That was his life anyway.
Right now, the reaction in South Africa to the death of Walter Sisulu 2 weeks shy of his 91st birthday.
Well, of course, there's a great sense of loss, a lot of grief, a lot of concern for Mama Sisulu, for Albertina Sisulu. They were exceptionally close. They were fortunate, though of course divided by 26 years when he was imprisoned, but they were always close. I know when, after 94, Albertina came into Parliament, Walter would come in and sit in the public gallery, especially if she was going to speak, or if any of his children, because two of his children were also in Parliament in those years. And that sense of family, and I think there is a lot of concern and love and empathy for her, because much as we may feel, we can imagine just what her own feelings are.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, and then we'll return with the Speaker of the South African National Assembly, Frenny Jinwala. Stay with us.
Silubonile nosizo lwabezizwe sithi enkosi enkosi siyabonga siyabonga ngalebuha yenkosi bantabo mntanami ibonake imisebenzi yethu sibabonile bentenu nami ngabe ngithithisela on June 16, 1976.
You are listening to Democracy Now! Our guest is Dr. Frenny Jinwala. She is the Speaker of the South African National Assembly and co-chair of the Global Coalition on Africa, a member of the ANC National Executive, a longtime activist for the African National Congress and women rights. In 1960, she left South Africa to arrange the escape of the late Oliver Tambo, the president of the ANC, and to help establish the ANC office in exile. Dr. Jinwala became head of the political research unit in the office of President Tambo and was known for her research on South Africa's nuclear program, sanctions, and the arms and oil embargo. She joins us on the telephone talking about Walter Sisulu, who last night died. 2 weeks before he turned 91 years old, spent a quarter of a century in prison under the apartheid regime, had spent his whole life fighting it, spent his time in jail alongside Nelson Mandela. Dr. Frenny Janwala, can you talk about those years, what it meant for Walter Sisulu and Nelson Mandela to be imprisoned, how pivotal that time was on Robben Island?
Well, of course, they were at one level cut off from us, but they still inspired whatever was happening. And after the first few years, we were able to communicate. And gradually, they were giving leadership from even where they were. But I think it was their inspiration that, if you like, was the fuel for the activism and the organization that continued until such time, eventually, there was sufficient pressure in the 1980s on the apartheid regime to force them to release first Walter Sisulu and then 2 years later, Nelson Mandela. And very, very typically, of course, no sooner had Walter come out of prison than he was back at something he excelled in, and that was organizing. And he began organizing the internal leadership of the ANC in preparation for its unbanning.
What about his force? What about his relationship with Nelson Mandela right through the period of Mandela's presidency, the president of South Africa? How much power did Walter Sisulu wield, as well as his wife, Albertina Sisulu?
I think it's not a sense of a formal power. He was a member of the ANC. He was deputy president of the ANC while we were still negotiating and when we first went into government and when President Mandela became president. But the way he influenced things wasn't an exercise of formal power. It was his wisdom, his ready availability to give advice, his strategic vision, because he was always the person who tended to see through you might call a sort of veritable net of counter forces and so on, and to get to the point. And prison didn't seem to have dimmed that in any way. During the negotiations, just before the elections, early in the morning, he, at his age, he was in his 70s, 80s by then, he would be there at 6:30 in the morning when the negotiations team met to look at it. And he was always incisive, getting to the point, clearing the way and saying, look, those things are irrelevant. This is the sticking point. This is what we must insist on. So his style of leadership, his style of exercise of power was one of giving advice, being there. And I think came from those who saw and had great respect for his vision and his understanding, including Mr. Mandela.
Dr. Frenny Janwala, you fought very hard to ensure women's rights in the South African Constitution, perhaps the most progressive constitution when it comes to women's rights in the world. Can you talk about Walter Sisulu's response to that effort?
Well, he was a Democrat with, you know, by instinct, if I can put it that way. And I don't think it ever occurred to him that women should be anything less than equal. In his own life, in his own family, women played their roles, not simply as sort of supporters, but Albertina, his wife, was an activist. Before they got married, she continued in the struggle. His children did the same thing. His daughter, who's now the Minister of Intelligence, was part of it. And at no point did he distinguish that these were women and therefore, one, they should not be involved or they should be less than equal. I think that's what I mean when I say he was a Democrat by instinct. He took it for granted. Of course, he encouraged his children. He encouraged all of us. And, well, I knew him as a very young student, and I don't think he made those kinds of distinctions between young students who were male or female. And he worked for equality for all people. He was concerned very much about the poor. And therefore, by the very nature of South African society, women were amongst the poorest. So they were amongst his greatest concern. He was concerned about workers. And once again, it was those in formal employment as well as those in informal employment. And that brought women within his overall vision as well.
Dr. Fernie Jhinwala, I wanted to ask for a moment if we could switch subjects and look at what's happening right now in Zimbabwe. President Robert Mugabe, coming under concerted pressure from three African leaders, including President of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, to begin negotiations with the opposition party. The information coming out in the United States is that George Bush, Tony Blair, Prime Minister of Britain, are pushing once again for regime change, this now in Zimbabwe. And so now we see Presidents Thabo Mbeki, the Nigerian President Obasanjo, Malawian President Bikile Mzuzi going to Harare yesterday to encourage talks and basically, it sounds like, for the stepping down of Robert Mugabe. I'm looking at a piece in The Guardian that says, after meeting with Mugabe, the leaders met with Morgan Tsvangirai, head of the opposition, for 90 minutes. Who said, the three presidents agreed with me that Zimbabwe is in a dire state. We agreed we have to work out a solution. And then the article goes on to say that Mugabe has not welcomed the pressure from his fellow African leaders. The state-owned Sunday Mail newspaper questioned whether the presidents were coming, quote, as African brothers or as agents of the British government. Can you comment on the role of South Africa in the attempt to basically push out of office Robert Mugabe?
No, I think it would be totally incorrect to see South Africa or the role of any of the other two leaders who were with President Mbeki as engaged in an exercise in regime change. Very much on the contrary. Our position has been all along, and it remains so, that the solution lies in bringing the two sides in Zimbabwe together, which means getting talks going between President Mugabe and Morgan Tsvangirai and, of course, their parties, because they're the only ones who can resolve it. Now, one of the things that did come through, and I'm now going by media reports, obviously, but also from an understanding of the situation, what did come through is for the first time, I believe, Morgan Tsvangirai said he was prepared to talk to Robert Mugabe as president of the country. Now, President Mugabe was still saying that the court challenge must be abandoned because the opposition parties are challenging the elections. But both sides have been engaged in court battles because Morgan Tsvangirai is also being charged with treason. But whether those cases are to be dropped or to be pursued simultaneously with talks, the South African and the African president's position would be they've got to resolve it amongst themselves. Certainly, there would be agreement that the situation in Zimbabwe is very poor, dire was, I think, the quotation you used, and we would agree with it. There are very serious problems, very serious hardships that ordinary people are facing. And this adds to the pressure for trying to resolve the differences. But I think this attempt, and this is what was important, that by talking to both sides and saying, come together, pushing them to see if there was a way of getting them to talk to each other, would be South Africa's major pressure. Earlier last year, we had the Secretary General of the African National Congress spending weeks in Zimbabwe trying to achieve exactly that, to try to persuade both sides to talk. We do not believe that change will come from outside. It can influence change. It can facilitate change. But it can't solve the problems which have to be done by Zimbabwe.
Do you think there's any relation to what's going on in Zimbabwe, scuttling international support for NEPAD, which is the New Economic Partnership for African Development, that Thabo Mbeki has very much supported, is very controversial, and is very much supported by the international financial institutions, the U.S. government? Do you support it?
Well, yes, we support NEPAD. I mean, we're part of it. But the fact that one country or anyone outside feels there's a problem with one country, we don't see why that should affect their relationship with the rest of the continent. I mean, there have been problems in Europe, in Yugoslavia, for example. That didn't affect relationships with the rest of Europe any more than problems on the in North America or whatever difficulties are there should affect it. So we don't think that you can sort of say that unless this is so, we will not support you, because we're assuming the support is genuine. The support is genuine concern, not about one country or not about saying you can only solve it in this way. The way the NEPAD program functions is that countries will have to comply with particular criteria before they benefit from programs. So in a way, countries in Africa have a choice, and countries outside Africa have a choice, because the criteria are there for all to support.
Finally, Dr. Frenie Ginwala, Speaker of the South African National Assembly, as we talk about issues of regime change, it takes us to Iraq and the U.S. invasion. Your stance on the invasion and what should happen at this point?
Well, I personally feel that we have moved backwards by virtue of the invasion, not so much the invasion as such, but by the abandonment of multilateralism. We spent a lot of 50 years building up a world that recognized interdependence, recognized multilateralism, built up institutions. And it is very sad that one power, which has the power, should just decide no, they will ignore that. In other words, if the world and the UN doesn't agree with them, they still will go ahead and invade another country. That, I believe, has set us back. We now clearly need to rebuild multilateralism in Iraq as well as elsewhere. So we really need to go back to the United Nations. United Nations is not perfect, but you don't abandon something, because what do you have in its place? The unilateral exercise of power is not acceptable to the rest of the world. We may have to put up with it because the United States is very powerful. That doesn't mean we accept it or support it. We believe we need to come back to a multilateral world. And the solution, the long-term solution to Iraq, must lie with multilateral institutions, with all countries coming together to help the Iraqi people and to move them forward, to help them, their economy move forward.
Dr. Frenie Ginwala, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Speaker of the South African National Assembly. Thank you. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we talk to an issue here at home. Some are calling him the bookie of virtue. William Bennett made millions lecturing people on morality, now blowing it on gambling. He served as Secretary of Education and Chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities under President Ronald Reagan. He was Director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy under President George Bush. He is the co-chair of the National Commission on Civic Renewal and the Partnership of a Drug-Free America, author and editor of 14 books, including the best-selling book, The Book of Virtues. His most recent project is Americans for Victory Over Terrorism, and he has recently written a new book called Why We Fight, Moral Clarity and the War on Terrorism. He's William Bennett. He plays low-stakes poker with a group of prominent conservatives, including Robert Bork, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, and Chief Justice William Rehnquist. But according to reports in two magazines last week, Bill Bennett also plays poker for high stakes. He's gambled and lost more than $8 million in casinos in Atlantic City. to Las Vegas. The article in the Washington Monthly is headlined Bookie of Virtues. The headline in Newsweek asks a question, virtue is as virtue does. Those breaking stories generated further unflattering headlines around the world. The Ottawa Citizen reports, anti-drug crusader can't say no to gambling, and the Guardian of London blares voice of morality exposed as chronic casino loser. In a statement released yesterday after the exposés came out, William Bennett said, quote, a number of stories in the media have reported I've engaged in high-stakes gambling over the past decade. It's true I've gambled large sums of money. I've also complied with all laws on reporting wins and losses. Nevertheless, I've done too much gambling, and this is not an example I wish to set. Therefore, my gambling days are over. We're joined now by Joshua Green, editor of the Washington Monthly and author of the piece, Bookie of Virtues. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to be with you.
Well, what do you think of Bill Bennett's statement yesterday?
Well, I think it was probably a wise move politically, and I think it was probably a good move for his family and everyone involved, really. I mean, the casino records we obtained just showed monumental losses, over the course of the last decade. And this from someone who's really made his life and made his role as a public figure, encouraging other folks to be virtuous. And he's usually first in line to criticize anyone who isn't.
Why does this matter? Is this a matter of what he personally does? Why make it public?
Well, I think it's different. I think it's difficult to be the sort of the self-appointed moral czar and pretend that your own actions aren't important or don't have any bearing on what you do. I mean, as Mr. Bennett is the first to say, he's become a very rich man. Speaking and writing books about the importance of controlling one's appetite and personal responsibility and virtues. And I think just about everyone who heard this story, understood immediately there was a disconnect between, that kind of sermonizing and Bennett's behavior in the casinos.
How did you discover this story, Joshua Green?
Well, I mean, this has been an open secret among conservatives in Washington for some time. I think only recently did some of them begin to understand the extent of his gambling losses. And there was also, I think there's quite a bit of animosity among casino industry workers, because Bennett's organization, the one that he co-founded, Empower America, is officially opposed to the expansion of casino gambling. So there was an obvious sort of a hypocrisy there, I think, on the part of or seen from the point of view of a lot of casino workers. Of, here's a guy who during the day is opposed to casinos, but spends the wee hour of the morning, pumping coins into a slot machine.
We're also joined on the line by someone you talk about in your piece, Tom Gray, executive director of the National Coalition Against Gambling Expansion in Rockford, Illinois. Tom Gray, what is your response to this story?
Well, I think it's a personal tragedy, and I think it points to something larger in the sense that this is a hidden addiction. It's even hidden from him. And I'm encouraged by the fact that he has said that he's not going to do this. My sense is that he's going to have help not to do this. You don't move from the type of high-level addiction that he was in and all of a sudden turn it off. The experience is that it's very difficult to stop this. But it's a hidden addiction in terms of the society, because Bill Bennett did not attack gambling. It was noticeable to us that he was largely silent on this issue. And we were trying to make a case that here's a person that was hard on drug, alcohol, and yet spoke virtually nothing about gambling, and he could have played a larger role. So our hope is at this point that perhaps this is a case. There are 5.5 million people with pathological problem gambling in the United States, and we think that that's a low estimate.
Can you talk about gambling as big business in this country? I mean, you have people like Frank Fahrenkopf, who were formerly head of the Republican Party, who then became the head of the whole gaming lobby in this country.
Yeah, I think what you have is the nation's on a gambling binge. I mean, we have states that are casino junkies. They are gambling the future of their budgets. Nevada's $700 million with a budget deficit this year. And if you could gamble yourself rich, Nevada would certainly be this. I think another tragedy with William Bennett, he probably should have stayed with low-stakes poker with the Supreme Court justices, but he was playing machines in the casinos. He was not James Bond with a blonde on his arm walking up to a poker table and playing a game of skill. You can have the IQ of a canned ham. That's the learning curve on playing these machines. The danger is that the casino people are now marketing a highly addictive delivery system of addiction, and that is the machines. They're even coinless now, where any sense of reality that you're gambling millions of dollars is lost by the fact that you're touching a screen and you're seeing credits appear. And I think this is the danger that America faces, that we've got on Main Street now throughout America machines that are somewhat like the invasion of the body snatchers. They take a person like Bill Bennett, who lives a very high moral, speaks of the life, and then he gets hooked up to the machine, and he is a slot machine, a serial junkie.
Joshua Green, you write about Bennett's organization, Empower America, opposing the extension of casino gambling in states, and how Jack Kemp, co-chair of Empower America, inveighed against lawmakers who, quote, pollute our society with a slot machine on every corner. And in an introduction written by Bennett, reports 5.5 million American adults as problem or pathological gamblers. Bennett says he's neither, because his habit does not disrupt his family life. He could become a very powerful spokesperson against gambling if he, in fact, can stay away from it.
The first things I noticed when reporting this story, you know, I went and bought a stack of his books. And, you know, Bennett speaks about everything from, adultery to divorce to child abuse to wife swapping. I mean, it was just, once you start looking for him to talk about gambling, it was really a glaring omission in a lot of his books. And I do think that Reverend Gray is absolutely right that, I mean, here is a man who has really had an impact on public policy as far as, influencing candidates and people at all levels. To listen to what he's saying. I mean, his Book of Virtues was a bestseller. It certainly has a lot of good things to offer. And it's sort of dismaying to think that he could have been doing some good on gambling, but chose not to.
Final comments, Tom Gray.
Well, I think that unfortunately he's still in denial, because if you look at the criterion for pathological gambling, preoccupation, while he was preoccupied, he risks significant relationships. I mean, his credibility, what more could a person have than the credibility of a position when you seek as a public person to try to elevate Americans' character and conduct? Chasing, losing money gambling returns another day in order to get even, escape, gambling away, escaping from problems. So I would hope that he would recognize and maybe join us. We really are in an uphill battle. The Frank Fahrenkopf's, the million-dollar man, and their $6 million budget in Washington influencing the political process. And certainly Bill Bennett would be welcome, but I think he needs to say, this is a personal problem that now is an American problem, and I want to speak on it.
Well, Tom Gray and Joshua Green, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and end with the sentence Joshua Green begins with in his piece in the Washington Monthly, The Bookie of Virtue, quoting William Bennett. We should know that too much of anything, even a good thing, may prove to be our undoing. We need to set definite boundaries on our appetites. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go back to the McCarthy era and look at the hearings that people didn't know about in this country, the secret hearings of Joe McCarthy that included people like Aaron Copland and Langston Hughes. Stay with us.
Now every gambler knows the secret to surviving is knowing what to throw away, knowing what to keep, 'cause every hand's a winner and every hand's a loser, and the best you can hope for is to die in your sleep. So when he'd finished speaking, he turned back toward the window, crushed out his cigarette, faded off to sleep. Then somewhere in the darkness, the gambler, he broke even. But in his final words, I found an ace that I could keep. You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, know when to run.
The Gambler, Kenny Rogers here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Newly released transcripts indicate that Senator Joseph McCarthy used closed-door secret sessions to winnow out witnesses who might have challenged him in the sensational anti-communist hearings more than a half a century ago. Of the 500 witnesses who testified in private, one-third were never called back to testify in public. Among those who testified in private were the composer Aaron Copland, poet Langston Hughes, and mystery writer Dashiell Hammett. Copland fiercely defended himself, saying, quote, "I've not been a communist in the past, and I'm not now a communist." Langston Hughes protested he had not read much about Marxism, quote, "beyond the introduction to the Communist Manifesto." Dashiell Hammett invoked the Fifth Amendment. McCarthy was a Wisconsin Republican. He headed up the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations in 1953 and 1954 at the height of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. His investigation into communists in the U.S. government was widely seen as a witch hunt and spawned the term McCarthyism to describe smear attacks. We're joined on the telephone right now by Donald Ritchie. He is associate Senate historian. He edited the hearings into the five volumes that were retrieved from stenographic notes on 9,675 pages of onion skin typing paper and housed for more than half a century in the National Archives. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Donald Ritchie. So can you talk more about these documents that have just been released?
Well, they're very interesting documents. They're insights into what was going on behind closed doors. We knew what Senator McCarthy was telling to reporters. He would step outside after these hearings, and he would give his version of what had happened, and that would determine what the headlines would be the next day. He was making sensational charges of spy rings and subversion and espionage, but now we're seeing what kind of information he was actually getting from the witnesses, how he had twisted, in a sense, the stories that they were telling, how little he knew about many of the people that were testifying before him, and also the tactics that he was using that ranged from occasionally being solicitous of the witnesses to bombarding them with questions and bullying them into trying to make contradictory remarks or to make incriminating remarks.
Can you talk about some of the people that it was not known before had testified in private because they were never called back, perhaps because McCarthy felt that they were, as you said, standing up to him?
There's a range of people. He started out investigating the State Department, which was one of his longtime interests, and he was essentially talking to high-level bureaucrats at that stage, and that's a traditional type of person who might testify before a congressional investigation. Then he switched over to an investigation of the U.S. information libraries abroad. And while he was supposed to be investigating the government, he called a lot of witnesses who were not government employees, and you mentioned Langston Hughes and Dashiell Hammett and Aaron Copland. Well, they were there either because they had written a book that turned up on the shelves of one of these information libraries, or because they had gotten a Fulbright Fellowship or some other government stipend to go abroad at some point. So anyone who, for any reason, had accepted funds from the government or had a book that was being promoted in a government library could be called up and then interrogated about their political beliefs. But then as the investigations continued, he began looking into really lower-level employees in the government, in civilian positions, and also in the army, people who were had never been called up before a congressional committee, were frightened to death, really, and often had no chance to get a counsel going in there. Really, couldn't defend themselves in many ways. The type of people he tended to call into the public hearings were those who either were going to kowtow to him, or those who were going to stonewall him, who were going to absolutely refuse to answer questions, take the Fifth Amendment. He interpreted taking the Fifth Amendment as an admission of guilt, and he used that to prove to, supposedly, to the press and to the public that he had indeed found dangerous subversives in the government. And those are the people he brought up into the public sessions. But the many of the people who were not called up either were so mistaken in the identity of the individual when they were called in, or had nothing that contributed in any way to the larger story, or defended themselves very well, stood up to him in the closed hearings, and they just weren't the kind of people that he wanted to tackle in a public hearing.
Can you talk about G. David Shine?
Yes, there's an interesting side to all of this, and that is that McCarthy hired a young assistant counsel. Chief counsel was Roy Cohn, who was 26 years old, who had been a prosecutor in the Rosenberg case and then who came down to work in Washington in the Truman Department, Justice Department, and then in 1953 was hired onto the committee. When Cohn arrived, he brought along his best friend, G. David Shine, who was essentially a rich kid. He was also 26 years old. He was the son of a family that owned major hotels in across the country. He was gone to Harvard. He drove a convertible with a car phone in 1953 to give you some idea of this was an extremely wealthy family. Had a suite at the Waldorf Astoria, and he came down with Cohn as the unpaid chief consultant to the committee, and it was really Cohn and Shine who gave McCarthy his big black eye for these hearings. In the spring of 1953, the two of them go to Europe to search out communist literature in the shelves of the U.S. information libraries. And of course, the European press, when they hear about these two, they just eat them alive. They rip into them at press conferences. They make fun of them in headlines. It's not the kind of treatment that Roy Cohn expected to get. He comes back really irritated about this and takes on a lot of the high-ranking officials in the U.S. Information Agency, several of whom lose their jobs as a result of all of this. Shine is still there through the fall of 1953, and he gets drafted. He's a young man who hasn't served in the military, and there's universal draft at the time. And he's called into the Army as a private. And he immediately begins to ask his friend Roy Cohn to get him special privileges, weekend passes from Fort Dix, get him assigned back to the committee, get him out of doing basic training, get him out of doing KP, get him out of doing guard duty. And Roy Cohn is calling the Secretary of the Army to get special privileges for this private in basic training. The trouble was that at the exact same time, McCarthy was investigating the Army. And eventually, the Army compiled a list of all the special favors that Cohn was asking for. And when McCarthy went too far in verbally abusing decorated officers who were testifying before him, the Army then released this list and said, look, on one hand, McCarthy is attacking our officers. On the other hand, he's demanding special privileges for this private. McCarthy responded, as he usually did, by attacking his opponents. And he accused the Army of holding Private Shine as a hostage to try to derail his investigation. And that forced him to step down as the chairman of the subcommittee so that his own subcommittee could investigate his own charges. And that's what set up the famous Army-McCarthy hearings in 1954, which were televised. Those were open public hearings. There were some closed hearings associated with that that we have published in these volumes, and we now see a little bit more about what was going on then. But Schein is really the trigger for all of this. And ultimately, everybody is destroyed in this except for David Schein. Roy Cohn, who expected to have a political career, never holds office as a result of this. He's always going to be linked to Joe McCarthy. McCarthy is censured by the Senate, and he's politically ruined as a result of this. But David Schein goes on sort of blithely to Hollywood and becomes a Hollywood producer. He eventually was the producer of the movie The French Connection, wins the Academy Award, and you know, lived a very glamorous life on the West Coast, I think fairly oblivious to the chaos that he caused back in Washington.
Donald Ritchie, what about the memorable moments with the authors who came under attack, people like Langston Hughes and Paul Robeson's wife, Eslanda Good Robeson?
Yes. I think the single most eloquent testimony in closed-door session was Langston Hughes's testimony. And probably the only reason he was able to give that testimony was that Senator McCarthy was absent from the hearing that day. And Everett Dirksen, senator from Illinois, was presiding. And Dirksen acted more the way a traditional senator would act, and that is he gave the witness a chance to express himself. Roy Cohn's tactic was to be a sort of a prosecutor, to interrupt the witnesses, to demand yes or no answers, not to allow them to make statements, not to allow them to explain themselves. He was trying to build a case against them. Senator Dirksen felt that if you called a witness, you ought to be able to hear what the witness had to say. And so he stops Cohn, and he allows Langston Hughes to speak. And Hughes gives this terrific autobiographical account of growing up as a poor young African-American in segregated America and why, in the depths of the Depression, he was attracted to radical politics and how he went to the Soviet Union with a film crew and how disillusioned he was by what he saw in the Soviet Union and how he had really changed his worldview as a result of all of that, and that his thinking in the 1950s was not the same as his thinking was in the early 1930s. It's a terrific explanation. I think many of the other witnesses might have been able to say that if they'd been given a chance. When Langston Hughes testifies in public, he tries to say this again, but McCarthy cuts him off, and so his public testimony isn't anywhere near as revealing as his closed-door session testimony was. Mrs. Robeson, on the other hand, she was there just because she'd written a biography of her husband that happened to be on a shelf in a U.S. information library. She wasn't about to give any explanations to Joe McCarthy. She just, you know, resisted. She wouldn't answer any of his questions. She took the Fifth Amendment. She also cited the 15th Amendment, and McCarthy was furious about that. But, of course, she didn't hold a federal job, and she wasn't about to cooperate with this committee, there was nothing that McCarthy could do to punish her in any way.
She said, I'm a second-class citizen in this country and therefore feel the need of the 15th. That's the reason,
right?
I use it. I'm not quite equal to the rest of white people. And Langston Hughes, when told to shorten his responses, said, I would much rather preserve my reputation and freedom than to save time. Donald Ritchie, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Associate Senate Historian. Thank you. And that does it for the program. We're going to link our website to the thousands of pages that have just been released from the McCarthy hearings. You can go to democracynow.org. We also video and audio stream the full expanded 2 hours of Democracy Now! And that does it for the program. Again, our website, democracynow.org. Our email address, mail@democracynow.org. You can get a copy, video, or audio of today's show, 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rybel, Vilka Suras. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Turn back toward the window, crushed out.